Hello, good evening. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. Our topic this summer evening will be skin care, skin protection, and the treatments for damaged skin. The skin is actually the largest organ of the body, and it's important to take care of it, especially during the summertime. Proper skin care can prevent skin cancer, which has actually become the leading cancer in the United States. Joining me this evening, we will talk about skin care with some local physicians that we have, and I'll ask them to go ahead and introduce themselves, starting with you, sir.
Good evening, Kenneth Sanders. I'm a facial plastic surgeon here in Shreveport.
Welcome back to Health Matters, Dr. Sanders.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Josie Futrell, a board-certified dermatologist with Arklatex Dermatology.
Dr. Futrell, welcome back to Health Matters. Pleasure to be with you tonight.
And this is Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist who treats plenty of skin cancer here in the Arklatex.
And you guys may recognize Dr. Katz's famous voice. He's also a host here on Health Matters. It's good to be with you as well on the other side of the mic. Thank you, Dr. Katz, for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And you all out there can also be with us by calling 1-800-552-8502 or tweet your question at RRR Public Radio. If you have a question about skin cancer, skin care, or any topic related to those tonight. So, Dr. Futrell, let's begin with you, if you will. What are sort of the keys to taking good care of the skin? We talk about lots of different organs. You know, we mentioned skin's the biggest organ of the body. Let's say, for example, we want to take care of our heart. We might eat right. We might exercise. Might avoid salt or cholesterol. What's the analogous regimen for taking good care of our skin?
First and foremost, always think of sun protection. Everybody should wear sunscreen. Sunscreen should be worn 365 days a year. I have people who tell me they're never out in the sun, but every time you climb in your car, you're in the sun. You want an SPF of 30 that has both UVA and UVB protection. Obviously, moisturizers to keep your skin from drying out, because dry skin is more subject to infection. And particularly for your face, the second most important beauty product after sunscreen is a prescription medication, Retin-A. If you poll 100 dermatologists, 99 of them are using Retin-A every day.
Themselves?
Yes.
Well, it sounds like a statin for cardiologists, if I can keep going with the cardiac analogy here. Tell us more about that.
You also want to certainly watch your sun exposure. Now, we live in Louisiana, so everybody is going to get a lot of sun unless they literally don't go outside their house. However, you want to watch your sun exposure, avoiding the peak UV ray times of 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. You want to seek shade when you can, wear sun protective clothing, and think about sun healthy things to do rather than trying to get your UV rays from something like the tanning bed.
So the tanning bed, that's a great question. I think we'll circle back around to that during the program tonight, because a lot of people do believe that that could be a safe substitute, if you will, to being out in the real sun. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. Our topic tonight is skin care, as well as summer skin protection. As anything related to that, the number for your questions or comments, 1-800-552-8502 for Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. Dr. Sanders, thank you for being with us. Why is the face somewhat more sensitive to some of the issues that happen with overexposure to the sun compared to, say, other parts of our body?
So it's not necessarily more sensitive, it's just more exposed. It's, you know, we rarely are covering our face, neck, ears, upper part of the chest. Those areas are exposed almost always. And so, you know, every time you're outside or in any kind of sun exposure, those areas are going to be exposed. Even if it's dead of winter and, you know, you're wearing your ski goggles, your nose still gets that sunburn right on the mountain. So it's not that it's more sensitive, it's just more exposed. Those parts are just always open.
And so are there any particular tips that you have in mind to give the skin of the face more extra protection?
I would really echo what Dr. Futrell said. Sunscreen every single day. I tell people this. And then a little more education deeper, a little deeper into sunscreen probably. I think I like to talk to people about the two main categories of sunscreens. There's a physical barrier and there's a chemical barrier. A chemical barrier is going to be less expensive, the stuff you buy at the drugstore. The Neutrogena spray we know and love on the beach, it works really well. Does a great job, but it gets used up in the process of blocking the sun rays, the UV rays. It gets used up. So even though your skin is still greasy 90 minutes later, it has no UV protection or very little. So you have to reapply it. Reapplication is extremely important. In fact, it's imperative for the chemical barriers. Every 90 minutes, if you're not reapplying, you're losing protection. The physical barriers are like the old-fashioned zinc oxide, the white stripes on the face and all. Nowadays, we have transparent zinc oxide. We have invisible types of physical barriers, and they're just as effective. You just can't see them. There's translucent powders. There's creams that are these type of physical barriers, and those really do not need to be reapplied so often. They're pretty much, once you put them on, they're there until you wash them off.
Those are excellent points. Dr. Katz, thank you for coming tonight. From your standpoint as a cancer doctor, radiation oncologist, what are the most common lesions that you see that could be potentially cancerous related to sun exposure?
Yeah, so I typically will see patients with skin cancer who've been referred to me typically by doctors such as Dr. Futrell and Dr. Sanders. Typically they're going to be basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. There are three major types of skin cancer, primary types. The basal cell carcinomas in particular, and then you have the squamous cell carcinomas, and the least common, however, the most serious and most deadly are the melanomas. What distinguishes the three is that the basal cell carcinomas are particularly common, and they tend to be locally invasive. They do damage in that particular area where they're growing, but they tend not to spread to other places like lymph nodes or other parts of the body. The squamous cell carcinomas, they start off small, and then they have the potential to become very invasive, very destructive, but also to spread to other parts of the body, either directly along nerve pathways or through lymph nodes, or even spread to other parts of the body. Melanomas, the malignant melanomas in particular, those are particularly dangerous because they can spread very early. And so those, when you find them, many times they can be already invasive. They may have already spread to lymph nodes or to other parts of the body. And those are ones that are much more difficult to treat. And generally, radiation doesn't play a very big role in treatment of melanomas. So surgery, and oftentimes extensive surgery, even for early stage melanomas, as indicated, and sometimes different types of chemotherapy. So what I see in my practice tends to be more of the basal cells and the squamous cell carcinomas. And those are oftentimes very, very treatable. But for the most part, they're all pretty preventable.
You know, it's affected our, the leadership status of our state, actually, now. Governor Blanco, actually in hospice care now as a result of malignant melanoma. They did an excellent piece on her not long ago here on Red River Radio.
And President Carter
was actually cured from metastatic.
Well, I think that's a stretch. President Carter had malignant melanoma that ultimately spread to his brain. Now, we can treat that in many cases if it's limited with certain types of radiation, very focused radiation, sometimes with surgery. And he did very well with his treatment, but usually it's not a cure. Usually it's just control until the next one pops up. So that's a perfect example of how serious these cancers can be.
And so obviously we want to prevent this scenario as opposed to having to aggressively treat with things like radiation and brain tumor resection and things along those lines. Dr. Futrell, from your standpoint, let's say we're just now tuning in. We're learning about sunscreen. We've had a lot of sun exposure. Maybe we're light complected. We've got some spots. How do we get those checked out?
You want to see either your family doctor as an initial step, or obviously seeing a board-certified dermatologist. We do routine screening of patients from head to toe. Just because you have had a spot for years doesn't mean that it's always benign. And the secret is, you want to be screened. You want to be screened once a year. Even I can't see my back, so I have to have one of my partners check out any moles I have on my back.
Are there any clues that maybe a spot is not behaving appropriately?
Well, certainly.
I know moles change over time, correct?
Exactly. Certainly, new moles or changing moles should be brought to somebody's attention. But we often talk about the ABCDs of melanoma. A being asymmetry, a mole that was round but now is irregular in shape. B, borders being ragged rather than smooth. C, color change. And keep in mind that while melanomas are often black, they can have no pigment at all, be red, or be other colors. And D, increasing diameter. So, new or changing moles. Now, for the basal cell and squamous cell skin cancers, a basal cell skin cancer may start off looking like a pimple, but a pimple goes away. Basal cell skin cancers don't go away, and they will enlarge, develop little broken blood vessels within them, eventually ulcerate. Squamous cell skin cancers often start as just a little scaly patch. And so they will gradually evolve and become deeper and thicker. Keep in mind, though, that just because something is flat, that doesn't mean that it is harmless. I have had more than one occasion where a patient came to see me that a lady came in and said, I want you to laser off this brown spot on my face. And I took one look at it and said, no, I'm not going to laser it. We need to biopsy it. And the particular person in question, I actually may have sent to Dr. Sanders, because she actually, when I biopsied it, did not just have a brown freckle. She had a melanoma.
Excellent points. This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and the topic tonight on Health Matters is skin care, skin cancer, and sun protection in the summer. You can call us with questions or comments at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet your question at RRR Public Radio. Our guests tonight include Dr. Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist from the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. Also, Dr. Josephine Futrell, board-certified dermatologist with Arklatex Dermatology here in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Kenneth Sanders, facial plastic surgeon in private practice here in Shreveport. Another one of the issues that comes up, Dr. Sanders, when we start talking about sun exposure are those little lines that happen from time to time. And that happens with age, I understand. Does sun have anything to do with that as well?
Yeah, sun has a lot to do with it. Another little parable, I guess, I'll talk to my patients about is there's really five things that are major factors with aging, and three of them we have no control over. So three of the five are time, gravity, and genetics. We can't really do much about those three right now. Maybe in the future, I don't know. But the sun and smoking, that's the two that we control completely, and actually the two that have the most impact on our aging of the face. So, let's say that most of us are not smoking if we're worried about our skin, that most people that are concerned with that are not smoking. So we'll take that one off the table and then talk about the sun. It is the number one in my practice aging factor that people deal with. And you just need to wear that sunscreen every single day. Even though you do, you're going to be gaining some sun exposure. Even if you are wearing that sunscreen, you're still getting some sun exposure. So, yes, there's some sun damage, some solar elastosis, we call it. That causes a thinning of the skin, kind of a fine lines and wrinkles, maybe even deeper wrinkles associated with, aggressive muscle contractions. Those lines can be, furrowed in pretty deep sometimes.
What are some of the techniques that you use to improve the appearance once that sort of already occurred?
So we do things to minimize the lines, like minor chemical peels, all the way up to full laser resurfacing, where we're literally peeling off the upper layer of skin with a laser or a chemical, and then allowing the new layer to grow back in, kind of freshened, fresher looking, usually a better color. more pinkish rather than the bronzing that you see from chronic sun exposure. And typically that gives a smoother appearance too, gives smoother lines.
Is there a role for surgery at any level when folks have, you know, some of these changes regarding, you know, the aging process that the sun may have contributed to?
Of course, there is. You know, the skin as it ages, it can become lax and then a little droopy in some areas. And then so sometimes the lasers or the chemicals or the Botox and fillers is not quite enough. Then surgery is more of an option where you remove some of that extra skin maybe, or you tighten the muscle layer or something like that to improve the appearance.
Are those generally effective techniques?
Very effective. Yeah.
So you mentioned Botox, you mentioned fillers, so we're going to come back to that in a moment. I'm going to go ahead and remind our listeners again that you can call and ask a question or provide a comment if you'd like. The number is 1-800-552-8502 or tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Katz, you mentioned you know, the most common types of skin cancer that you see. Are you aware of any other cancers that could be related to excessive sun exposure?
There are other types of skin cancers that we see that are more minor. I think that sun exposure plays a smaller role in the development of those. So, you know, in terms of the ones that we treat primarily, it's the three big ones. The other ones being much more minor. If I may, even though I'm on this side of the mic, I do have a question along the same lines of what we were talking about for Dr. Futrell, if you
okay,
don't mind.
You have to come over here and sit in this
seat. Okay. Okay, but don't get up. I'll just sit. Okay. No, I want to just go back real quickly to the retin-A, since we were talking about you know, we're talking about things to put on your skin, and
right.
Dr. Futrell said that 99% of dermatologists use it, which is, I believe, higher than the percentage of dentists who recommend sugarless gum. So I'm curious, what does the retin-A do, and why is it so desirable that so many dermatologists are using it? Because I remember using retin-A as an adolescent for acne, but I understand that's only one of the ways that it's used now.
Exactly. Retin-A was originally developed to treat acne, and it's still one of the things we use every day in our acne treatment programs. However, it's also been shown to remodel and restore collagen up to a point. Therefore, while it cannot do everything that a laser can do or other things, it can prevent and restore some of the collagen that is lost from photoaging. And that's why you will see dermatologists using it.
Does it make your skin more sensitive to the sun when you take it, though?
Generally not. The biggest problem with retin-A is that it can be drying or irritating. Now, there are ways to minimize this. First of all, by starting people off slowly. A lot of my patients with sensitive skin, I will start them on retin-A or tretinoin every other night or every third night, gradually working up to nightly. Secondly, you start with a low strength. As their skin becomes used to the retin-A, so to speak, you can often increase the strength. And I often add in moisturizers with it. Now, if your skin is extremely dry from retin-A and you go out in the sun, yes, you're going to be more sensitive to the sun. But I use retin-A 365 days a year, and I'm a runner, I'm a beach person. I certainly go out in the sun. I tell people I have my retin-A on at night, and I wash it off in the morning and put on my sunscreen.
You know, let's get back to sunscreen. But before we leave retin-A and go back to sunscreen, actually, it's tretinoin. What is actually in that compound? What's the you know, pharmacologic action involved with retin-A? How does it work?
We don't know all of the things about how the collagen is remodeled. It actually, for the acne standpoint, kind of reorganizes and resets the oil glands. It's not an antibiotic. It's totally different. And actually, the oral acne medicine, Accutane, is a derivative of tretinoin. It's a similar medication. So it's acting on the oil glands, but it has other effects.
Okay, so excellent information. So back to sunscreen. There's a lot of, you know, issues around sunscreen. Is it very common that you see people who have overexposure to the skin because they don't like sunscreen, whether they think they're allergic to it or some other sensitivity? I've had you know, experience with the so-called heat rash whenever sunscreen is applied. Is there a Is there a legitimacy to an actual allergy to some of the components in sunscreen?
There certainly can be people who are allergic to certain components. This is why I think Dr. Sanders made a very important point. He tends to favor the so-called chemical-free sunscreens, which, of course, there's no such thing as something being chemical-free. But the barrier sunscreens that contain zinc oxide or titanium dioxide, you're generally not going to be allergic to those substances. Now, you could be allergic to a preservative in the material, but that's where you go if you have people who have sensitive skin or, again, sunscreen allergies.
Is there such a thing as heat rash? People who get an allergic dermatitis when they are overexposed to the sun, say that once, that first trip to the beach in the summer, and they get this diffuse rash where they were sun exposed?
There can be all kinds of rashes caused from heat, but one of the more common problems is that the sweat glands get overloaded and you get what's called kind of a miliaria rash, where they're kind of stopped up. And it takes several days to a week or more for that to go away sometimes. It can be very itchy and very unpleasant.
Is there a way to prevent that?
Sure there is. Stay cool.
if it hurts when I do this, don't do this. Okay,
I mean, you have to be careful. I mean, because anybody's skin, if you overheat, you're going to have problems.
Excellent points. Again, you can call and ask any of our guests a question or offer a comment. 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Sanders, have you been acquainted with any of the newer techniques used to prevent aging? You know, people talk about stem cell injections and things along those lines. Is there any way that you could educate our listeners about what's coming down the pipeline in terms of anti-aging techniques?
So stem cells and another product called PRP, I think people have heard a lot about that.
That's called regenerative medicine sorts of things, right?
Right, right. PRP is a acronym for platelet-rich plasma. And so how you get that is you draw the blood from the patient and then process the blood and take little parts of it out. And it happens to have some stem cells in it, some growth factors and some activated platelets, and all those things are good for a healing response. And so the healing response, we know it does a good job of plumping collagen, and that's what gives us sometimes when we do laser resurfacing or chemical resurfacing, that's what we're looking for, a healing response. And so if you can do that without causing such damage like a chemical peel and a laser, you have to go through the damage part to get the healing. You can do that by injecting these products possibly into the skin. That's why this is such a hot topic. So you can avoid the damage phase and just get the healing phase. The way I like to do it is create maybe some micro damage. So we have a device called a micro needle that is used to penetrate just deep enough into the skin to get this product into the dermis and create a little bit of this healing response. And that does cause, like Dr. Futrell mentioned, some collagen bundling, some collagen remodeling, and maybe some plumping, which makes things look a little smoother and a little better.
Great points. Let's go to the first caller of the evening. We have Carrie from Shreveport. Carrie, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to know your opinion if getting the artificial tan, like in a spray tan booth, if that's a safe alternative. I try to stay out of the sun and be careful, and the tanning booth allows me to have a little bit of color, but I don't really know if it's safe.
The spray tans I find are very safe. The ones we do this in my office spa we have, and they use an all-natural product. It's a plant dyes, basically, so it's not really a chemically-based tan. The spray tan is definitely, it's probably the safe alternative to tanning.
Okay,
Dr. Futrell, do you have some comment on that?
I have a great comment on that. I tell people that I sleep in sunscreen, but I can also tell you that I get spray tans. The other advantage, and since we're on radio, you can't see me, but I'm a senior citizen. The other advantage to the spray tans is we get the advantage of our skin looking smoother with them, a little less crepey. And going to a physician's office, I think Dr. Sanders and I have probably the same equipment for spray tanning. You can get a hand-sprayed spray tan. You can get it lighter or darker. When you're a senior citizen, you don't want to go quite as dark because it makes you look older. So you get a safe tan, but a beautiful one.
Well, when I was recently in at the tanning booth, I noticed there was a warning sign, and I had always assumed that the spray tans were safe, and it was something maybe DHE was the chemical, and so perhaps I need to do more research and go with what you guys are describing with a natural plant-based product. So thank you for taking my call.
Sure, I'd like to add one thing to that though. A lot of products are toxic in excess. So if you were eating the material, it would definitely not be safe. However, I will say that I know at our office, we do not do spray tans on pregnant women generally. There's no real evidence that it's not safe, but we avoid that simply to be on the absolute safe side.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Carrie, thank you so much for calling. Again, the number here is 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Speaking of pregnancy, Dr. Futrell, is sunscreen generally safe in pregnancy?
Again, if you're using something like zinc oxide, titanium dioxide, absolutely. These are pretty inert materials. And since the second biggest cause of cancer deaths in young women, 20 to 29, is skin cancer, protecting your skin at an early age is very important.
That's a great point, protecting the skin at an early age. I've heard of some movements where the healing properties of the sun are thought to protect children from maybe childhood illnesses, and that sunscreen could be not a great thing for kids. Is there any rationale to exposing kids to the sun for healthy reasons like vitamin D exposure and things like that? Or do kids need the same amount of sun protection as adults? Obviously, we show our sun exposure more when we're older compared to being younger. But could you speak a little bit about pediatric sun care?
I think this is two topics. First of all, the necessity of getting vitamin D. Getting vitamin D from a supplement is every bit as effective as getting vitamin D from sun, and it's a lot safer. Secondly, most of us are going to get plenty of sun even if we're wearing sunscreen. Now, most of us get the vast majority of our sun, greater than 50% of it, the first 20 years of our life. So using sunscreen on small children, I'm not necessarily saying a four-week-old baby, but on small children, helps to protect their skin and helps to keep them from getting sunburns, which are one of the big risks of skin cancer as they age. Now, there are some sunscreen products that, again, I think are safer than others. I certainly don't recommend taking a can of sunscreen and spraying it directly in a child's face. But there are powdered sunscreens and other things that you can do that are safe for children. But also keep in mind the wonderful sun-protective clothing that now exists that both children and adults can wear. And like a lot of kids, and you'll see them at the pools and beaches now, they have on their little swimsuit, but they also have on a little swim jacket, or what you want to call it, that covers their arms and torso that really helps to protect them. And my grandsons, when they're at the pool, they have on their little hat, except when they're going down the big slide.
Yeah, that's a great point. From your experience, are there variations in the protective nature of clothing, for example? So can I assume that I don't have to put sunscreen underneath if I'm wearing a white shirt versus a gray shirt? Or do I need a swim shirt to get full protective potential from clothing?
You can't assume that a white T-shirt is going to protect you entirely. Now, certainly having on a shirt of any kind is going to be better than not having on a shirt. But depending upon the weave of the fabric, you may still get a lot of sun through that shirt. Incidentally, one of my patients came in the other day and showed me they actually have hats that have SPF factors protection now. And you can actually go online, Google these things, and you can find companies, very reputable companies, that provide sunwear that is actually protective, and they've actually shown it to be a particular SPF protection.
So lots of options. We have many options in terms of sun protection via sunscreen as well as sun protective clothing.
Dr. Brewer, I think it's important as you talk about sun exposure and the young, not just children, but even young adults, is we have to consider the type of exposures that people are getting at young ages, and also the intensity of the radiation that the solar radiation that they're getting. When you look at the statistics in terms of who's getting skin cancers at the young ages, it's predominantly women, and women are much more likely to be using tanning beds. And the association between tanning beds and developing skin cancer is one of the most closely studied types of carcinogens that we have. It's actually a class one carcinogen, the same as plutonium is. And it's classified as much of a carcinogen. That's how close it's, but you basically have smoking, plutonium, and UV radiation. Okay, those are three class one or group one carcinogens. And so if you actually look at the association between skin cancer and tanning beds, you see a higher percentage of cancers, skin cancers caused by tanning beds than you do lung cancers caused by smoking, which is an astounding percentage when you hear it. And so that's why there are actually laws in many states that make it illegal for people under the age of 18 to even get on a tanning bed. So
it sort of makes no sense that it's legal. You know, I know we have free will and freedom of choice to, you know, in terms of our healthcare decisions, but to me it doesn't make sense that we would allow people unlimited exposure to radiation from a tanning bed.
But it's a $1 billion industry, and unfortunately that speaks. I would like to second what Sandy said. When I went into practice 30 years ago, I rarely saw young women with melanomas. Unfortunately, now I do. And invariably, when I see somebody in the 20 to 30 age group, they are using indoor tanning. And as few as 10 visits a year can increase your lifetime risk of melanoma significantly. So it's not a good idea to go out and spend that 2 or 3 weeks before you go to the beach in the tanning bed. That's actually increasing your risk, not decreasing it.
And I think when you do it at a young age in particular, you're even more susceptible. I think that it's not just the number of sessions, but it's also how susceptible you are at what point in your life. And then, you know, so young people in particular doing this, it's not a free lunch. It may come back to haunt you 10, 20, 30 years later. But I think that there is something biological going on where you're just more sensitive to the carcinogenic effects.
Let's go to Chloe from Shreveport. Chloe, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me. I wanted to know if you have brown spots on your face from sun damage, is it safe to have them removed with photofacials, and will this reduce your cancer risk?
Dr. Sanders, brown spot removal with a photofacial.
Photofacial. So what she's talking about is either an intense pulse light or a laser, some sort of light source that we use to remove brown spots. So this is something that's done every day in my office, probably in Dr. Futrell's office as well. But when you go to a physician's office and have this done, or someone like myself or a dermatologist who is familiar with looking at brown spots and saying, well, all of this looks safe to just have removed with the treatment versus like Dr. Futrell mentioned earlier, this is something that we don't want to do. We want to maybe biopsy this. So there's a trained eye can make a big difference. Something that I think needs to be kept in mind when you're going to have something like this done, brown spots that may or may not be safe to have removed, a physician that is well-versed in skin cancers and skin care in general is probably better than the spa at the mall or what have you. So it can be safe. It should be looked at with a trained eye, though.
Chloe, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you so much.
So this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. Our topic tonight is skin care in the summer. We have three excellent guests with us tonight. We have Dr. Sanford Katz, a radiation oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. We also have Dr. Josephine Futrell, a dermatologist with Arklatex Dermatology, as well as Dr. Ken Sanders, facial plastic surgeon here in Shreveport. Again, the number for any questions or comments you may have, 1-800-552-8502. You know, one of the issues people have with regards to taking things off their face is the cosmetic appearance. What's this going to look like afterwards, Dr. Sanders? What are some of the techniques that you have to repair, you know, some of the excision of these lesions, and what are the options that patients may have once they have something taken off?
So I'll generally see people. Sometimes I see people primarily, they just have a bump they want removed. And sometimes I see patients Dr. Futrell might send over that she's removed a bump and then they want to do something cosmetic to fix it. Or it's been even bigger than that. A Mohs surgeon, a dermatologist, takes off big skin cancers, sends them over, and they have a big hole. So there's always options to improve the way things can look on the face. So if we're just going to take off a small thing, very small, a shave biopsy may be the way to go. And you can really heal without a scar, essentially, up to a certain size. After that, once we get beyond a few millimeters, maybe 5 or 6 millimeters, then we need to maybe start talking about excising those, making a tiny little cut, an elliptical shaped cut, and then closing it very precisely in some good wound care, and that usually will give us something nice. And I'll usually tell patients, like, look, this is maybe not a favorable spot to make a cut. We have to do it. We have to get this off. We have to get rid of it. In the end, we'll have this almost invisible. And that's words I use a lot, almost invisible. And that's achievable. We can really get that. It should not be that difficult to with the technology we have now, the laser stuff we do and dermabrasions and skin care that we use, we can really take wounds that are made, that have to be made on the face in visible areas, and make them almost invisible.
You mentioned the term Mohs surgery. That's something that we hear about a lot. Explain to us, any of the three of you, I'm sure, have expertise in discussing this particular type of approach to skin lesions. What's Mohs surgery?
So Mohs surgery is a term that's used by a dermatologist that is trained in pathology as well. So the dermatologist is cutting off a lesion off the face or off the body anywhere, in my case, usually the face. They're cutting this skin cancer off, or this thing they think is a cancer. And where the improvement over the other technique would be, if I cut it off and I send it to the lab, then they call me back either in an hour or a few days and tell me whether I got it all. That's the typical kind of what I call the old-fashioned way to do it. The better way, in my opinion, is to use a Mohs surgeon, especially for malignancies, especially for complicated areas where we want to keep the excisions small. So he or she, the Mohs surgeon, can cut this off, and the same person that cuts it off then reads that tissue immediately in his own or her own office. And so just the precision of that person knowing what he cut off, where he cut it off, and then looking at that slide improves the effectiveness, improves the failure rate is very, very low. When I used to do this, before we had a Mohs surgeon in town, I would have failures where the pathology would be read initially as negative on the quick check, the frozen section, and then the permanent pathology would come back, and they would say, well, maybe not. We think we need to go back in. Well, at this point, I've already done the reconstruction. So now I've got to open things up, go back in, take out more tissue. It's very difficult, bad on the patient, just not a great way to do it. That would happen once a month or every 6 or 8 weeks. That was a pretty, if we're doing a lot of skin cancers, that's a relatively common thing. With Mohs surgery, I have done one in the past 5 years. So it's a very low failure rate. Much, much better for the patient, much better for me to have to know when I'm closing something up, it's clear.
Yeah, so if I can add, conceptually, when you were talking about treating skin cancer, particularly on the face, there are really three objectives that you're looking at. One is to get rid of the cancer. Two is to preserve the function of the area. Let's say it's on a lip. And also the cosmetic result. So the way that Mohs surgery differs from traditional surgery is, as Dr. Sanders said, is you have the surgeon actually looking at the specimen slice by slice, microscopically, and making sure that no cancer goes to the edge of where they're cutting. Because the analogy I like to make is if you had a rusty piece of pipe and you could see where the rust was, and your job was to cut out the section of pipe and replace it with some fresh pipe. If you only cut to the edge of where you saw the rust and you replaced that section, it wouldn't be long before you had rust growing on both ends and on the sides. And that's because rust, just like cancer, it occurs at a very, very small dimension that you can't see. So if you take too little, you end up with residual disease. If you don't know, you err on the side of caution. You want to take more. But then the more you take to make sure you get all of it, the greater the chance are that you're going to have a defect, and that's going to affect either the cosmetic result or the function. So by having the Mohs surgeon have more security that, hey, I got it all because I looked and kept cutting and cutting and cutting till I saw it was clear, it limits the size of the defect that someone like Dr. Sanders then has to correct. And it also improves the cure rates because you have more confidence that you got off the cancer.
Great explanation. We have another question via Twitter, actually. We have a gentleman who's asking, he has dark spots under his eyes, and he sent us a picture in his 30s, and he's been told it's due to a lack of sleep or lack of sufficient hydration. And he would like to know what your opinions are, doctors, what this gentleman could do to treat the dark spots around the eyes, or can it be prevented with better sleep or better hydration? Dr. Futrell, is this something that you see in your practice?
Yes. Now, I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about, but a lot of people have dark or black circles under their eyes. And while certainly sleep can play a role, this is often not the major factor. One of the big factors is that these people often have little leaky capillaries. And so the dark pigment is not actually melanin or the pigment we see in our skin. It actually comes from the hemoglobin from the blood vessels. And so you can't use bleaching creams on this. It's not going to work. Now, there's several solutions. There's no perfect or easy solution. One solution, again, Retin-A, eye creams, moisturizing. But sometimes this skin is lax and there's really nothing you can do but something like a blepharoplasty. Again, though, bleaching creams will not solve this problem. And so a lot of people spend a lot of time and money on this and don't get the desired results.
Dr. Sanders, you know, the issue with hydration comes up in this question. How important is hydration in our facial appearance? And obviously the summer is a common time to not have adequate hydration. Do you see that as playing a role?
I think hydration is really important for skin in general, all skin. In our climate, you know, we're in such a high humidity that we really don't know about skin dehydration like, say, somebody lives in Arizona would know about. I mean, you can look at pictures of a crowd of people in Shreveport versus a crowd of people in Tucson, and you can tell where you are just by looking at the skin. So, you know, we use hydrators every day, moisturizers, hydrators, things that add moisture to the skin. I think they're really important. They're a basic part of skincare. But we really don't know about dry skin so much in the Southeast, in the South, than like some of the more arid climates do.
And up north, too. I'm from up north, and I'll tell you that people down here have more youthful skin, even looking skin, even though you'd think, well, there's more sun exposure, it's going to be, no. And I think it's because of the dry, long winters, their skin, there's a lot of dryness that we don't have down here.
We may have time for one more question. The number for your call is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question, as previously occurred, at RRR Public Radio. Again, this is Dr. Randall Brewer. Our topic tonight is skin health during the summer. Dr. Katz, you know, we talk about risk factors that are modifiable. We've talked about a lot of those tonight in terms of skin cancer, tanning beds, sunscreen, protective clothing, and things like that. Is there a genetic basis, especially, you know, type of skin, whether it's light complexion or a darker complexion? Are there other non-modifiable risk factors involved when it comes to getting skin cancer, especially melanoma, the most malignant form, or potentially fatal form of skin cancer?
There are some genetic syndromes, and there are some genetic predispositions that some people have that puts them at particularly high risk for developing skin cancers. You can't really modify those, but if you are aware of them, then you can certainly modify your behavior, modify your exposures, use judicious use of skin creams. Oftentimes, those are identified relatively early because you start to develop skin pathology at a very, very young age, or there's a strong family history of skin pathology related to exquisite sun sensitivity at a very young age. Interestingly, those same people are not only very sensitive to sun exposure, but they can be very sensitive to radiation exposure as well. And so there are times when we have people come for radiation treatment, and because they may have a particular syndrome, then they may not be a candidate for radiation treatment because the risk of complications is too high.
What about complexion? Are light-complected, people of, Caucasians are more likely to get skin cancer compared to a black or brown persons?
Absolutely. So, the fair someone is, red hair, blonde hair, very fair, fair-complected people are definitely more sensitive to the sun, developing sun damage and skin cancer, certainly. The darker-complected people, less so. But that's not to say that people who are dark-complected or more pigmented cannot get skin cancer. They certainly can. Also, skin cancer is not unique to just lightly complected people. African Americans can also get skin cancer. They tend to get squamous cell carcinomas on their skin, and then the melanomas they tend to get more on their hands or their feet. So, if you're a very darkly pigmented person and you notice any of these warning signs, either in the nail beds or in the feet, or palms of the hands, don't necessarily assume that you can't get skin cancer.
Dr. Futrell, should darker complected persons wear sunscreen as well?
Absolutely. This is important for two reasons. One, skin cancer, but also people with darker complexions still don't like to get dark spots on their skin. And the so-called sunspots are not caused by age. They're caused by sun. And nobody likes their complexion to be darker than what their norm is.
We have a question that was sent in via Twitter as well. Apparently, it's a parent of a teenager. So those of us out there who have teenagers, perhaps we can relate. The question is about mood alterations as a result of being treated for acne. Side effects of Accutane. Could mood changes or mood alterations be a side effect of acne treatment?
All right. Now, Accutane, if you go on Accutane, you actually have to sign consent forms. And one of the consent forms deals with Accutane and a potential increased risk in depression. The reality is that in Canada, Norway, and maybe one or two other countries where they have national health systems, they've done controlled studies that do not show any increased risk in depression and or suicide in an Accutane versus a non-Accutane population. Teenagers in general can have a lot of mood swings. What I tell my patients who are on Accutane and their parents is that if somebody experiences something that is considered to be a serious mood swing, then we need to be notified and we may have to consider taking them off the medicine. But I think that this is something that is probably somewhat out of proportion. I'm also old enough to realize, though, that there's no such thing as something being impossible.
But, you know, it brings up a really good topic when it comes to, you know, skincare, summer sun exposure, and acne in general. Is there any indication that exposure to the sun will improve the control of teenage acne or adolescent acne symptoms?
There's no real statistic advantage to that. And actually, of course, because the sun dilates blood vessels, it may actually make your acne look worse. I think one thing to remember about teenagers and acne, though, is that it's a big social problem for teenagers. It can directly affect their self-esteem, and acne can be scarring. And if it's scarring, it can be scarring for life. Dr. Sanders and I both have cute little lasers that can remove a lot of acne scars, but you can't ever get rid of all of it. And so treating these patients and treating their psychological and self-esteem needs can be equally as important sometimes as treating the actual disease.
And Dr. Sanders, in addition to your cute little laser that Dr. Futro mentions, you mentioned earlier Botox and fillers. In the last couple of minutes that we have, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what Botox is, where or where you should not use it, and what sort of fillers that you might use and where you should or maybe shouldn't use those?
So Botox is different than a filler. That's the first step, I guess. A lot of people get that confused. Botox will not plump your lips. So let's start with Botox. It's a very purified, very small portion of a botulinum toxin molecule. It's not toxic. It has been used since the 80s. Literally, there are people that have been having Botox injected in them since the mid-80s, probably. And very safe product that is used to relax muscles. That's what it does. If you inject it into the face, almost always in my practice, the face, what that does, it goes to the what's called the neuromuscular junction, and it makes that muscle not react to that nerve fiber for about 3-4 months. That's all it does. And so the reason we do that is because a lot of the lines on the face are called dynamic lines. So when you smile, you have these smile lines maybe around the eyes, between the eyes and the forehead that you don't like. It looks a little older. Then if you relax that muscle, you get a little less lines, and it looks better, looks smoother. It's a very effective product. 96% or so of people that get it again. So that lets you know just how effective and good a job it does. I think it needs to be administered by a physician. I know Dr. Futrell feels the same way. We've talked about this before. We both stand firm against non-physician injectors. And on to fillers. Fillers are just what the name implies. It's used to fill an area, a depression, an area of fat loss. As we get older, we tend to lose fat in the face, or it moves, and so we can use fillers to replace that volume, and facial volume is very important to have a more youthful look. So there's different types of products now. We have a wide array of fillers that can be used in different areas, around the eyes, in the lips, in the cheeks, in the temples, just really all over the face. Fillers are very well tolerated. It's made of the same stuff that is in our skin already, called hyaluronic acid. That's why it's very well tolerated by the body. Our body doesn't see it as a foreign product. And so that's what we use for fillers.
Well, thank you so much. That was Dr. Kenneth Sanders. He is a facial plastic surgeon here in Shreveport. Also, thanks to Dr. Josephine Futrell from Arklatex Dermatology. And also thanks to Dr. Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist here at the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. Consult your physician or healthcare provider for all health concerns. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters do not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, Louisiana State University School here in Shreveport, or its staff. This show will be available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with assistance tonight provided by Mr. Wally Derleth, Sheila Lawrence, and Mr. Tim Snell. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next week at this time for another edition of Health Matters.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right.